Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 25th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast on cancer to go along with a special section in the magazine. We'll hear about targeted cancer therapy, mechanisms of metastasis, and immunity's role in cancer. Also, from our Science Now team, some of the latest science news, including a story about how a dinosaur is like a vacuum cleaner.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It's been 40 years since U.S. President Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act, promoting the work of the National Cancer Institute. While clinical care has really changed, it wasn't until the 1990s that cancer rates began to decline, at least in the United States. And perhaps that was due to stepped-up efforts to limit or eliminate people's exposures to carcinogens, such as asbestos and cigarette smoke. More recently, progress has been made in understanding how genes drive cancer development. For each individual cancer clone, Mike Stratton says around 5 genes may be driving development. Stratton is director of the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and writes a review article in this week's special section on cancer.
It's possible that in some cancers there are more, and it's also thought that perhaps in some cancers, particularly of the blood system, some leukemias, each individual cancer may require fewer than 5, possibly only 1.
Where researchers have found just one or a few genes that drive a particular cancer's growth, such as chronic myeloid leukemia.
Science News writer Jocelyn Kaiser writes about targeted therapies in this week's special section on cancer.
They've gone on to design drugs that target the molecular machinery of that cancer and stop it from growing. So the idea is that a patient comes to see the doctor, they're diagnosed with cancer. The doctor takes a biopsy, a sample of their tumor or cancer, and tests it. They test it for genetic mutations that might be driving the growth of the cancer. And then they can give that patient a drug matched to the particular mutations that are important in their cancer. Or the doctor may need to give the patient a combination of drugs because there's more than one mutation driving the growth of their cancer. It's the same idea that's used with AIDS patients who receive a cocktail of drugs to stop the HIV virus. And one example where this is being done is with chronic myeloid leukemia. Charles Sawyers is working on ways to give patients with that disease a cocktail of drugs.
There's some compelling cocktail ideas.
Charles Sawyers of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center researches the signaling pathways that drive the growth of cancer cells.
But we've only got one of the two or three ingredients we need to stir the cocktail up correctly. One drug's still experimental, whereas one is already approved, or one we just don't even have the drug yet. The science is telling us to do these cocktails, but we just don't have all the ingredients on the shelf yet.
While Sawyers has had some success in helping patients with chronic myeloid leukemia through a drug he helped develop called imatinib, or Gleevec, cancers inevitably develop resistance to these types of targeted drug therapies. The reason? The targeting essentially selects for resistance, and the few cancer cells that have or develop resistance can expand and take over. The question for the future of these kinds of cocktail strategies is what happens when patients develop resistance to a cocktail of drugs. Again, Science's Jocelyn Kaiser.
So doctors may have to keep testing their tumor for genetic changes and giving them a tailored cocktail every time they start to resist the previous combination of drugs. And one thing that will help is finding more mutations, more genetic weak spots in tumors by systematically sequencing a lot of cancers. And that's what Mike Stratton is working on with his team.
So if we are interested, and I think we should be.
Again, cancer geneticist Mike Stratton of the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute.
In finding genes that are relatively infrequently mutated, but nevertheless driver genes contributing to cancers, we then have to analyze not 10 cancers, but 100. And for some of these genes, 1,000. And that is at the core of the current initiatives to sequence cancer genomes, to do really quite substantial numbers, so that we then access more or less the full repertoire of cancer genes, whether they're operating commonly in one or more types of cancers or rarely.
But while sequencing cancer genomes will help researchers design drugs to limit cancer's effects, Stratton says the ultimate goal must still be to kill the cancer. In particular, it can take only a few months for a patient's cancer to develop resistance to a drug, where it can take 10 to 15 years to develop a new drug to overcome that resistance.
Our aspiration should be to achieve cure. And this is not just banner waving. We know that it can be done. It's not so much from the recent advances in targeted cancer therapeutics, but we know from the much earlier advances in cancer chemotherapy, the advances in the leukemias, particularly of childhood, the advances in testicular cancer of young men, where previous diseases which had extremely high mortality now have 90% cures because of cancer chemotherapeutics that kill all the cancer cells. So it can be achieved, and that is still what we should be aspiring to. What we need to understand much better is why we achieved those successes those decades ago in the leukemias and testicular cancers, and what are the differences between those cancers and those treatments compared to other cancers and the targeted treatments we're using today.
In this week's Science and available online, read news, reviews, and research on cancer. It's free with registration. You can also see a video about targeted cancer therapies. Find it at sciencemag.org/special/cancer2011. One of our most powerful defenses against cancer, our immune systems, can detect and destroy some tumors or prevent them from growing well before they ever show up in a clinical setting. But there is evidence to suggest that in doing so, the immune system is essentially selecting for cancer cells that do not alert the immune system. This hypothesized dual role of the immune system, suppressing and then essentially promoting cancer, is gaining consensus in the cancer research community. And in a review article in this week's special section on cancer, Robert Schreiber and colleagues write about this hypothesis, the immuno-editing hypothesis. I spoke with Schreiber from his office at Washington University in St. Louis.
This term, immuno-editing, actually emphasizes the dual role of the immune system in not only eliminating tumors, but also to help them grow in an immunocompetent host. We selected the term very specifically. It's based on an older term called immunosurveillance, a term that was proposed maybe 50 years ago that was to indicate that the immune system was purely protective in its interaction with developing cancers. But we now know from our experiments that that's not the case, that it's not only protective but also promotes tumor development. And so we sought a term that maintained at least a little contact to the original concept of immunosurveillance, but broadened it to demonstrate the dual role of the immune system in interacting with cancer. So we thought of editing as a good modifier to this term, because just like a writer would edit a manuscript, throwing some things out altogether, shaping things, and eventually coming out with a variant of the original draft that was different and maybe improved. In this case, in the cancer cell, it would be improved for the ability to grow. We felt that immuno-editing was a very good term to support this concept. So when we talk about tumor promoting, we're really talking about the immune system shaping the immunogenicity of a tumor as well.
To extend the metaphor slightly, the drafting and the editing, these things take place in a timeline. Is that the idea then, that there's timelines on which the immune system is first preventing cancer and then promoting it?
Yes, I see this very much like a timeline. The first interaction, of course, would be the protective role of the immune system. This would be in a tumor cell that has not been altered at all by its interaction with the immune system. Here, the immune system would see a developing tumor and either destroy it or control its outgrowth. And as this process, then, especially if one is controlling the outgrowth, if as this process continues, we see it as a sort of long-term battle between the genetic instability of tumors and therefore a constantly changing target, with the ability of the immune system to select against tumor cells that have antigens or that it can see and therefore destroy. So we see this process occurring in three different phases that we've called elimination, which is the protective phase, equilibrium, a time in which if the immune system hasn't killed everything off, it's now can maintain the outgrowth of some tumor cell variants, which are still present in the individual. And then ultimately, this is the phase where editing occurs, and then if, in fact, a variant is formed by the interaction between the immune system and this constantly moving antigenic target of a tumor cell, eventually you might be able to develop a variant which can no longer be controlled by the immune system, and then it grows out. So we see that this may occur over many years. In humans, it could be over a 20, 30-year period, but ultimately what comes out is a tumor cell that is no longer controllable by the immune system.
To what extent does this cancer immunoediting hypothesis fit with the observation that inflammation, typically associated with the immune system, is also associated with cancer development?
In many cases, they are overlapping concepts. There's been a running battle for several years that you either can have inflammation in cancer or you can have immunoediting in cancer. We never subscribed to that. We always felt that these processes could occur perhaps at different times temporally, but nevertheless could certainly coexist. So we think that we can actually incorporate the concept of inflammation and cancer into the cancer immunoediting hypothesis.
Two applications. Ultimately, does this cancer immunoediting conceptual framework suggest different courses of cancer treatment or prevention?
It at least raises the opportunity that we can make cancer into a chronic disease. And certainly most of the efforts in the past in immunotherapy of cancer have been to use the immune system to destroy and eliminate cancer. But I think what the immunoediting concept has added to it is the demonstration of this experimental demonstration of what we call the equilibrium phase, a time in which the immune system is actually controlling cancer outgrowth. So the cancer is there in very low numbers, but the cancer cells remain there, and the immune system is what is controlling its outgrowth. It's a sort of immunological tumor dormancy that is obviously caused by the immune system interacting with the tumor cell. And I think that this raises the possibility that this could be a therapeutic endpoint. And so I would say that the cancer immunoediting process gives credence to the possibility that if we can't use the immune system currently to destroy cancer, perhaps we can use it to make cancer into a chronic disease. And this may actually relate to some of the things that are being done clinically now. And so I think that the concept of both cures and control via immune system activation are definite endpoints of the immunoediting process that have been predicted by this concept.
Robert Schreiber, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Robert Schreiber of Washington University in St. Louis is lead author of a review article on cancer immunoediting and integrating immunity's role in cancer suppression and cancer promotion. It's often said that cancer doesn't kill, metastasized cancer kills, with estimates that suggest up to 90% of cancer-associated mortality is due to metastasis. Yet metastasis is very poorly understood. In part, that may be because a metastasizing cancer has to do a lot, and so there's a lot to understand. A metastasizing cancer cell has to leave the primary tumor, invade the surrounding tissue, enter the lymph and blood systems, survive whatever trip, usually through the bloodstream, to another of the body's tissues, leave the bloodstream, survive within some other tissue, and adapt and colonize and so form a secondary tumor. But as Christine Chaffer and Bob Weinberg write in a review article in this week's special section on cancer, reconceptualizing metastasis and simplifying all those steps down to just two steps may help researchers in identifying exactly what gives cancer this ability to metastasize. I spoke with Chaffer from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she works at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research and the Ludwig MIT Center for Molecular Oncology.
We make that simplification because although we can think about the steps of the metastatic cascade, although we can break them down into discrete steps, in reality, the biology that allows a cell to complete those individual steps cannot be necessarily accounted for by different biological processes. That is to say, we have found that one process, which is called the epithelial mesenchymal transition, this process known as the EMT is a developmental process. So it's a process that is used during development, and it's a process that allows cells to acquire motility, so to become mobile. It enables cells also to become invasive. And also, it's been found that the EMT also allows cells to survive in an anchorage-independent manner, such as would be required in the bloodstream. So in that sense, the EMT can empower cells with the ability to complete pretty much the first five steps of the metastatic cascade. So in that sense, we're able to group all of those initial steps, so local invasion away from the primary tumor, intravasation into the blood vessels, survival in the bloodstream, as one process, because we can explain how cells can acquire the ability to complete all of those steps by one process, which we believe would be the EMT.
These cells that have undergone this EMT, the epithelial mesenchymal transition, what's the selective pressure for these traits that enable a cancer cell to go from being an epithelial cell to a mesenchymal cell, to leave the main tumor and move elsewhere in the body?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's one that a lot of work has been placed on at the moment. We have the impression that there are cells within a primary tumor that are perhaps poised to be able to undergo the EMT. And we think that there are signals from the stromal microenvironment, so from the tissue, the cells that surround the primary tumor, that can activate cells within the primary tumor to undergo the EMT. And at the moment, we don't understand what the exact signals are that enable the cells to undergo the EMT. We have an idea of what some of these signals can be, but certainly we don't understand the exact combination that allows for this EMT to occur.
These are the so-called cancer stem cells that aren't necessarily present at the origin of the primary tumor, but are origins of or founders of secondary metastasized tumors?
Yeah, so certainly a recent advance has been that cells that undergo the EMT have been known to associate with cancer stem cell traits. So this does tell us that there are cells within the primary tumor that are not necessarily cancer stem cells to begin with, but if the appropriate stroma is required and the appropriate microenvironment is set up, these cells can be forced to undergo the EMT and acquire cancer stem cell-like traits. And the advantage for that is that not only does the cell then acquire the ability to migrate and invade away from the primary tumor and to survive in the circulation, once it gets to the primary site, if these cells do have cancer stem cell-like properties, then theoretically they are empowered with the ability to then seed a secondary tumor. So cells that undergo the EMT, which can acquire migratory and invasive ability, doesn't necessarily mean that they can also seed a tumor once they get to the secondary site. It simply means that they probably have an increased ability to get there. However, recent research has suggested that cells that undergo the EMT do indeed have cancer stem cell-like traits, and thus they can seed a secondary tumor. So it raises an interesting issue about the cell of origin of primary tumors. And to date, it's really not known what the cell of origin of a cancer stem cell is. One theory is that given that cancer stem cells have traits that are similar to stem cells, that in fact a pre-existing stem cell within a tissue might undergo oncogenic transformation and thus be transformed into a cancer cell. That stem cell, which has been transformed into a cancer cell, should have the properties of a cancer stem cell. So this suggests that there are perhaps two ways in which cancer stem cells can arrive. One, they can arise via the oncogenic transformation of a pre-existing stem cell within the tissue. Or alternatively, now we're beginning to understand that a cancer stem cell can also be created from a non-stem cell within a tissue. And if that non-cancer stem cell undergoes a process called the EMT, it can thereby acquire cancer stem cell-like properties. So we think that there are these two different alternatives for ways in which a tumor might generate cancer stem cells.
To what extent are there any collaborations going on between cancer researchers, those studying the origins of these cancer stem cells that undergo a carcinomic transformation, and researchers working on induced pluripotent stem cells, the taking of normal cells and turning them into ones that can essentially, the hope is, proliferate into a variety of types of cells? Are there collaborations going on between those two communities?
So the field of iPS cells has certainly informed some of the ways that we think about cancer research. For example, the identification of the four factors that can transform differentiated adult cells back into the embryonic stem cell state do seem to be important in the maintenance or the generation of the cancer stem cell state. So in that way, the collaborations between those two fields have certainly informed the way that we think about the biology of the cancer stem cell. So basically, we do know that the cancer stem cells are a very important component of tumorigenesis. And certainly clinically, it's going to be very important for researchers to try and understand how cancer stem cells are maintained in the cancer stem cell state. And in doing so, the idea would be clinically to be able to eradicate cancer stem cells from a patient. By eradicating cancer stem cells, theoretically, we hope to be able to stop the spread of cancer from the primary tumor, but also to be able to stop the outgrowth of micromets that might already exist in a patient at the time of presentation. And in order to be able to do that, we really need to understand what drives a cancer stem cell to proliferate and what drives it to self-renew and to maintain its cancer stem cell state. So understanding the transcription factors and signaling molecules that keep the cancer stem cell in its state is going to be extremely important for therapeutics.
Christine Chaffer, thank you very much.
Okay, Robert, nice to speak to you.
Christine Chaffer of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research and the Ludwig MIT Center for Molecular Oncology is co-author of a review article on cancer cell metastasis. Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about how a dinosaur is like a vacuum cleaner. Dave, how is a dinosaur like a vacuum cleaner?
Well, Rob, it has to do with the dinosaur's neck. And this story is all about how these very large dinosaurs, and there's two types in particular. One is known as Brachiosaurus, and the other one is known as Apatosaurus, formerly known as Brontosaurus, for those of us who remember that old designation. But these were huge dinosaurs. These guys weighed in excess of 80 metric tons. They were longer than two semi-trailer trucks put together. And they also had really long necks. Brachiosaurus's neck was 9 meters long, which is about five times as long as the neck of a giraffe. And what they did with these necks is kind of like the action of an old-fashioned vacuum cleaner. Rob, do you remember those old vacuum cleaners where they had a really heavy body and they had that long sort of tube coming out of the body and the body would just sort of stay in one place, but you could use the tube and the attachment to get into the corners and everything like that. And you really wouldn't move the body around that much. You were just moving that tube around a lot. Well, that's what researchers think was happening with these dinosaurs. And although it seems like a simple answer, this has actually been a very controversial question. Researchers kind of agree on why these dinosaurs were so big. These dinosaurs lived in a time where there was a lot of predation, so the larger you were, the more protected you were. And also, if you were bigger, you had a much larger stomach, which was important for digesting all the vegetable matter that these dinosaurs digested, and these dinosaurs were herbivores, not carnivores. But the size of the neck has been a real matter of dispute. Some researchers said they had these really long necks to reach up into the trees and grab vegetation, kind of like giraffes do. And others have said they actually use their necks to forage on the ground. And so in this new study, researchers researchers used some mathematical calculations and, yes, some comparisons to classic vacuum cleaners to figure out exactly what was sort of the most energy efficient use of these necks. Because you imagine a creature that big, they've really got to conserve their energy.
Lifting their head up is not conserving energy.
Well, it's not so much the lifting the neck up and down that consumes energy. It's the tremendous energy needed to pump blood into the head. You're talking about pumping blood against gravity three stories high. That requires a tremendous amount of energy. So the question was that a good use of their energy? Or did it make more sense for them to sort of forage on the ground where they wouldn't have to do that? And the researchers found that indeed, it was a lot more energy efficient for these dinosaurs to forage on the ground. And this neck length of 9 meters was actually very ideal. If the neck was only 6 meters long, for example, it would have been less efficient. A 9-meter neck actually saves 80% more energy than a 6-meter neck because it can gather more food without the dinosaur having to move its massive body around. Again, think about these classic vacuum cleaners. The longer the dinosaur can stretch its neck, the less it has to move this gigantic body, and so it's not consuming as much energy. But beyond 9 meters, you actually start to lose the energy savings. So that was the first thing they discovered. All this sort of adds up to the idea that these dinosaurs probably spent a lot of time foraging on the ground. But the researchers say the dinosaur was actually saving so much energy that it actually could afford to also grab up into the trees as well. Even though that would have cost the dinosaur some energy for pumping all that blood, it would have been saving energy it would have otherwise spent moving its tremendous body around. So the dinosaur actually could have done both.
So an interesting modeling experiment. Are researchers using this kind of modeling for other purposes?
Well, we didn't really get into the article about what the applications are. We at Science Now like to say that dinosaurs are cool and just leave it at that.
Okay, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, while we're spending some time in the past, this next story is about prehistoric heaps of garbage and how they may have actually helped improve a modern ecosystem.
Which modern ecosystem are we talking about here?
Well, Rob, we're talking about the Florida Everglades, which are wetlands in Florida. And there's an interesting feature of the Everglades, which is that there's a bunch of these so-called tree islands. And these are basically patches of relatively high and dry ground that raise up about 1 to 2 meters higher than the surrounding landscape. And they cover about 100 acres. And what's most important is that they're hot spots of biodiversity. They host 2 to 3 times the number of species than the species living in the surrounding marsh. And they're really important, actually, habitats for animals like alligators and the Florida panther, especially during flood season. It gives these animals a higher elevation to escape to avoid the waters. And for a long time, scientists have just assumed, well, these mounds are sort of just like any other mound. You see, they're probably made from a little wrinkle in the underlying bedrock and nothing more to think about. But in this new study, researchers have a much more interesting hypothesis for how these mounds form. And they say that these mounds were actually started by prehistoric humans who were basically just throwing all their trash into a pile. And researchers call these trash piles middens. And these middens could have been composed of discarded food, charcoal, shell tools, even broken pottery, the prehistoric version of garbage. And what would happen over time is that these small garbage mounds would offer a foothold for trees, shrubs, and other vegetation, and that the bones in these trash piles would have been a really good source for phosphorus, which is a nutrient that's otherwise in very short supply in the Everglades. So basically what these researchers are saying is that these humans sort of planted the seed for these tree islands by discarding all their food in a pile, and then over time, these piles grew and grew until they ended up being the tree islands that they are today.
So did these researchers dig underneath these islands and find this trash? What's their evidence?
So what they did was they actually did go off to the Everglades and they dug down into these tree islands. And the researchers found when they dug down deep, they actually found a midden. So that was strong evidence that that could have been how some of these tree islands formed.
Is this a hypothesis for all of these tree islands, Dave?
Well, not everybody agrees, or at least not everybody agrees that this explains all of the tree islands. One of the researchers quoted in the article says his own analysis suggests that these tree islands actually started to form before people arrived. Even when there's middens, if you dig down deeper than the middens, there is still evidence of a tree island starting to form, but that formation was taking place before humans were even on the scene. So it's possible that humans may have helped the tree island grow by throwing trash into a pile, but in some cases, there may have already been a mound to begin with.
But I'm guessing that the overall message here is not that we should just throw our trash wherever we please and say, oh, well, we're just starting a midden for trees to grow on someday.
No, it's a good point, Robin. In fact, while this does show that early human garbage was actually probably beneficial for ecology, or at least ecology in this area and biodiversity, our modern trash is not as benign as these old piles of food and carcasses and shells and broken pottery. Our modern trash is a lot more toxic to the environment. So I wouldn't advise anybody trying to create a trash midden in their backyard.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of things you shouldn't throw away, this last story is about our electronic devices and specifically finding a way to charge them a lot faster than we do right now.
So battery technology, some advance there?
Exactly. The problem with modern batteries is twofold. First of all, it takes a long time to charge them, and it also takes a long time to discharge them. Now, if you think about charging, yeah, it's annoying when you've got to wait overnight for your cell phone to charge or your iPad or whatever. But think about some of the technologies that are coming up in the future, technologies like electric cars. The idea is that you would drive your electric car into perhaps a gas station that's actually an electric charging station, and you would charge your car. The problem is the amount of time it currently takes to charge these batteries, your car could be sitting there for hours, which is not very efficient if you just want to head to the grocery store. So if you had a quick charging battery, you could charge your car essentially as quickly as you fill up a tank of gas. And on the discharging angle, when we talk about things like solar power, one of the problems with solar power, it takes a long time to discharge this power from a solar fuel cell. So in other words, if solar power is maybe a backup for regular power and that regular power goes down, solar power can't take its place immediately because it takes a while for it to release that energy. But if you get it to release that energy a lot quicker, then the solar power could kick in and you wouldn't even notice that you had lost electricity. And so there's a lot of reasons we'd want batteries to charge and discharge a lot quicker than they do now.
So what's the innovation here?
Well, Rob, the chief innovation here is increasing the surface area within the battery. Part of the reason it takes batteries so long to charge and to discharge is because it takes a long time for the charge to actually move through the battery to get to where you want it to go. And so what the researchers did in this study was they designed this lattice within the battery that has a ton of nooks and crannies. And when it's filled with this charged storage material, the electrons in the material never have that far to go before reaching the battery's metal and then being conducted away. So the distance between your energy and where you want that energy to go is greatly reduced. And where the researchers tested out these batteries, they found that they charge and discharge up to 100 times faster than existing batteries do. And they held just as much, if not more, power than current batteries do.
So the question then, I guess, before we see these in our cars and cell phones and everything else, is how much can they scale up this technology?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. One of the advantages with this approach is that the approach the researchers used is already being used in industry today. It's actually part of the manufacturing process. So this wouldn't be hard to translate into manufacturing. And they do believe that this technology can be easily scaled up, although they haven't shown that yet. And that's going to be the next big hurdle, is to figuring out, can you scale this up to something the size of a laptop battery or even a large car battery?
How big is their battery now?
The battery now is about the size of a watch battery. So you can imagine that the applications for something that small are limited. So obviously, they really do want to see if they can make this work in a much larger battery, although they say they're confident that they can do it.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the smell of pain, figuring out exactly why some people lose their sense of smell. And it has to do with a receptor that also helps us feel pain, and also a story about creating sperm outside of the body and the implications that has for in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we have a story about why the National Science Foundation is in hot water over U.S. science education. And we're continuing our very extensive coverage on the Japanese earthquake, the tsunami, and the aftermath, everything that's going on in that country. We are covering stories almost every day on that topic. We're also taking questions from readers and answering the most pressing questions our readers have. And you can find all of this on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the March 25th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.